This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We've heard many predictions in the past few years about how the new information technologies will change our lives. The book will become obsolete. The university campus will be replaced by courses on the internet. And more than half of American workers will work out of their homes. My guest, Paul Duguid, is the co-author of the new book, The Social Life of Information, which attempts to separate the cyber hype from reality. Duguid is a historian who is a consultant at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, which his co-author John Seely Brown directs. Their book expands on a series of essays they wrote about how the design of new technology affects how people learn and work. Duguid disagrees with people who predict the book will soon become obsolete.
Well, I think one of the things to get clear first is that, you know, the book has for a long time held together a great many different sorts of objects. It's held together railway timetables or airplane timetables or car parts catalogs. And there is no doubt in my mind that if I needed to consult the car parts catalog or have someone do it for me, I'd much prefer them to do it using a CD-ROM or an online database than flog back and forth through a book. So in some sense, what seems to be happening is some of the things that are really not very well adapted for pages bound together between covers have now left the book, and that seems to be well worth it for everybody. But in some ways, the way a book contains within a certain length what the author has to get across, and as you read it, barely noticeably, you know, your left thumb and finger are getting closer together, telling you that the story is winding up without any conscious interruption to the way you're reading. Or the way, conversely, the short story will suddenly come to an end, clunk, and you won't have realized that it's winding up. The things that authors use in order to get their story across, to convey their meaning, to evoke certain circumstances. And those are the sort of subtle aspects of a book, I think, that is very easy to miss or underestimate. Also, of course, as people like John Updike recently talked about, you know, books do furnish a room. If you have them on the walls of your house, people can somehow understand what you read, where you've come from. They're great ways of signaling our own intellectual background and learning. That doesn't quite work with a row of CD-ROMs. So there are a lot of subtle effects of books that I think will probably keep it in play for a long time.
It's been predicted that people won't have to go to the office anymore because we have so much office and information technology that we can use at home that can interconnect us to the other people that we work with. And I think it is true that many more people are working at home and many more people are working with colleagues who live in other states or other cities or other countries because they can interconnect through email and faxes and phones and so on. But you raise a lot of the problems that you have if you're working at home alone, technological problems even. What are some of the problems that you see?
Sure. Well, here I have to say I speak from the heart because I do most of my work at home alone. Mm-hmm. There are many reasons that I would never want to go back into an office life of 9 to 5 and that feeling of sort of trapped, that your time is someone else's possession during the day. But I think that some of the talk that, you know, by now we would all be living in electronic cottages and some predictions that by the year 2000 downtowns would be dead have clearly not come true. And I think the reason for that, again, is that those making the predictions have underestimated what it is, on the one hand, that keep people together in offices, and on the other, that make work at home alone rather an isolating and difficult experience. And strangely, much of the technology that is meant to help us get from the congested office out into these wonderful electronic cottages seems to me in some ways to have been a good deal of the problem. A lot of us have been sent home with what I think of as industrial strength technology and assumed that alone we could somehow survive on that. And people who work in offices know that when a software upgrade comes through, it can be something like a dose of the flu, laying people out for months, for weeks on end. And of course, if you have to manage that alone without IT managers, et cetera, et cetera.
IT is information technology.
Without somebody who is an expert in managing that, but you're really trying to install new stuff on your own, following these wretchedly inadequate manuals and web pages, it can be enormously difficult. Very frustrating, and drive some people back to the office from whence they thought they'd fled for good.
I think with all the new technology, a lot of companies want to be sure that they're on the cutting edge, and they want to rearrange the corporation in a way that's congruent with all the new technology, that suits and reflects the new technology. And some companies end up making some big mistakes along the way. And you cite at least one of those in your new book. Talk about the hot desk.
Well, the hot desk was really this idea that not only did we not really need to work in offices, but if for some curious reason people would still have to come to a central place, they would no longer need to have their own particular workspace, their own particular wall on which they would pin up paintings or their children's drawings or their diary or whatever, that they could simply come in the morning and pick up a laptop and a cell phone and go off to a little cubicle on one side and do all their work there. And if you look at things from what we call the logic of technology, this seemed actually a wonderful idea. But the logic of humanity, which tends to work rather differently, undermined it. One of the things that they discovered in the office was that while people will often say that offices instantiate a certain sort of pecking order and the hierarchy is very heavily marked, when you pull away all restraints, the turf wars are even worse. So people would fight over the best places in the office. People would try to send in their assistants early in the morning to get the best hot desks, no doubt with the sun or nearest to the coffee. And there was every day a reformed turf war, which really made people very unhappy. And the notion that this would lead to an egalitarian office, I think, was very quickly undermined.
Now, where was this tried?
This was tried at Chiat Day, the great advertising agency that created much of the Apple Think Different advertising, and they clearly were thinking different in some interesting ways. But I think that they came unstuck and realized after 5 years that this wasn't the way the office was ready to work, and they had to go back to an older and more established form of office.
Let me get to another prediction that we've been hearing, which is the traditional university will be replaced by cyber universities, where you'll be connected to the information that you need or the teacher that you need online and through the internet.
This is one that has interested us a good deal. And in the book, we open with an example from a rather celebrated IBM advertisement of an elderly grandfather talking to his daughter in a vineyard in Italy. And it's a very elegant setup. And they have English subtitles as they talk in Italian. And he reveals to his daughter that he has just received his PhD from Indiana University, which is a very nice reversal. You would expect it to be the granddaughter who would announce this. And then he announces the reason he was able to do this was that the university had put its library online. And that struck us as extraordinary in its conception of what education is, what the university is, what changes will do. It seemed to say that really getting a PhD is simply a matter of having an access to a library. And perhaps in that there's the early idea that really getting information, getting an education is simply a matter of getting information, and that what teachers do is simply ship information to you, and we can probably do that better technologically. And anybody, I think, who sits and pauses for a little while about their education will realize that simply being informed was only a minor part of it. Becoming socialized, meeting your peers, learning from them, watching people who were perhaps not very articulate but expert in their fields carry out their job, the whole social world of schools and universities is suddenly cut out of the picture, and all you get is this thin stream of information. And it's easy but very misleading to believe that that's the core of education.
So I guess one of the points that you're making here is that there's a big difference in receiving information and actually learning, comprehending and having knowledge.
Yeah, I think there really is. The psychologist Jerem Bruemer, I think, makes a wonderful distinction between what he calls learning about and learning to be. And learning about is the way that we pick up bits of information here which sound interesting and we pass on and we can chat about, but we can't really do anything with. I can watch a program about penguins in Antarctica, as I did last night, but I'm never really likely to become an Antarctic bird fancier on the basis of that. But the other thing that Jerome Bruner says we do is we learn to be. That is, we inquire an identity. We become writers or scholars or radio interviewers or engineers. And that's a much more intense and process which involves our entire identity, which brings us in as, brings in our whole personality, brings that to bear on what we're learning. And I think that's the sort of thing that genuine education starts to get at. And that's why it's very different from simply picking up bits of information here and there.
My guest is Paul Duguid, co-author of the new book, The Social Life of Information. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is historian Paul Duguid. He's the co-author of the new book, The Social Life of Information. One of the big controversies now surrounding information on the internet has to do with copyright. Mm-hmm. You know, should recording artists and songwriters be given royalties when somebody downloads their music? Should writers be given any kind of royalty if somebody reads something on the internet, downloads something that the writer has written? Some people feel, no, the great thing about the web is that it's democratizing information. We have a new technology, and that requires new ways of dealing with information sharing. And you know, the ideas of ownership of information are out of date now, and that's a good thing. And I'm wondering your thoughts about that as a historian studying this.
Well, historically, it has some interesting precedent in that in the 19th century, you may know, America refused to sign on to international copyright laws, which, for instance, made the visit of Charles Dickens to America in 1842 a very tendentious occasion, because Dickens came along and said, here you are, you're praising me, you love my work, but you won't pay for it. It's pirated around the country. And at the same time, as new presses were being put up, as the way in which a newspaper could be put out very quickly and contain an entire book if they chose was emerging, people were making the argument that you hear again today, that the law of property in law of intellectual property is immoral, that ideas should be free. I don't think they said information then, that there is no reason that anybody should be paid for what is, in a sense, God's knowledge. So there is a precedent for that, and I think it is one of the huge challenges we see today, and is tending to push in a couple of different directions. One, I think, is it's tending to try to discover technologies that will control minutely our every interaction with information. They are now trying to create technologies that if I download pages over the web, they will allow me to read them once and then the page will dissolve. If I want to pass that page on to somebody else, I have to pay a second fee. If I want to make a copy of it, I have to pay a third fee. And those are changing from one end to regimes of extraordinary control. And those, I think, are pretty worrying. But at the other end, as someone who lives in part by writing myself, the idea that I can't make a living out of what I write, that it can simply be taken from me and passed around, is, among other things, going to stop me and people like me from writing. I'm not going to say that my writing would necessarily be a loss to society, but I think the general sense that if nobody is going to be interested in protecting intellectual property, there will not be much interesting intellectual work done, which is the other side of the minute control, I think is equally worrying. And it's going to take quite a battle, not just a technological battle, to find a way between these two extreme positions.
Right, and what I was talking about too, though, is that you know, the internet is not only freeing up information and democratizing it, but it's a store. It's a big store now.
Yeah, and more and more things that I think in the past were of necessity accessible and free are actually now being sold to us. I spoke to a friend of mine who wrote a wonderful book about San Francisco, Imperial San Francisco, not long ago, and he said that he thought he couldn't do the research that he did for that book, A History of San Francisco, that he couldn't do that research now because so many of the sources which were public access not long ago, particularly to photographs, now he would have to pay for every item. So there is a shift, in a sense, to commercialize a great deal of what we once thought was free. And that's happening a certain amount with libraries who are suddenly discovering that they can make money out of parts of their collection, and so free access is no longer being allowed. So yes, I think that behind those great claims of democratization, there are a lot of very savvy and rather unfortunate commercial moves being made.
One of the things I'm wondering about is if culture is going to become more fragmented, if we're going to be more separated from each other than before. And I guess what I'm thinking is this. Now that there's cable TV and so many different options on the internet, we're not all watching and listening to the same things like we once did. Culture keeps subdividing and subdividing, which is fine. It means that our special interests are getting better addressed than ever before. The only downside of it, I think, is that we used to have pop culture to hold us together. We'd watch the same TV shows and read a lot of the same books and see the same movies. I think people are still seeing the same movies because there aren't that many choices, in movie theaters. But the rest of culture is becoming so fragmented.
I think it is, and becoming particularly difficult to talk about. I mean, maybe one thing it does is it challenges some of the old generalities that we used to make about technology and about culture, and assume that people were all looking at these things together in the same way. And perhaps there already was something of a balkanization, even when everybody was reading very little more than the Bible several centuries ago. The different ways that they read the Bible, the different and wholly opposed groups that formed around it, maybe in some way prefigured the sort of balkanization that we're getting now. I think, as advertisers obviously tend to think, what this sort of fragmentation does is it puts an enormous premium on those things that can pull people together, on the occasional big movie, the big show, CBS and Survivors. Those things become more and more significant, not only financially for the advertisers, but I think in some ways more culturally significant. I think a little while ago some of us might never have thought of watching Survivors, but because it is such an extraordinarily significant program in pulling people together who have been fragmented, suddenly it takes on a much greater interest.
My guest is Paul Duguid, and he's the co-author of the new book, The Social Life of Information. As a historian, I imagine one of the things that you particularly enjoy is holding in your hands a document from another era, which you don't get to do if you're finding information on the internet and everything is contained on a screen.
Yeah, and for me, such documents can often tell you a great deal about how, in a sense, looking at information alone is a limiting process. To take an example, I was working in an archive in Portugal from the things I was looking at from roughly the time of the Revolutionary War, so 1770s, 1780s. And these boxes contained letters. They're about the size of a styrofoam cooler, and they will contain the entire year's intake of letters to a firm, and many of them have barely been disturbed for 100, 150, 200 years. And I unfortunately tend to suffer from asthma. So as I pick these things out, my eyes will run, my nose will run, and I will feel that the one thing I would really like to do is scan these documents, put them on the web, and never have to deal with these layers of dust again. And one day I was sitting there reading these documents with a handkerchief around my face, looking like a bandit, trying to keep the dust out of my nose, when this man came in and sat down beside me and started to work on another box. And he picked them up, and he would pull out a letter, and he wouldn't even read it. He'd put it under his nose and drag it from side to side and take an extraordinary deep sniff, which sent my sinuses into complete shock as I saw him doing this. And he carried on doing this for about 10 minutes, and once in a while he'd open a page and he'd make a small note, and then he'd fold it up and put it away again. And soon after, British resistance was overcome by intense curiosity, and I turned to him and I said, "Look, what on earth are you doing?" And it turned out that he was a medical historian, and he was tracing outbreaks of cholera in the 18th century. And when cholera broke out in a particular town, the authorities, as the mail went out, would sprinkle it with vinegar to disinfect it. And so now, 200 plus years later, by sniffing the letters, he would still get the faint trace of vinegar, and he would know how the disease had spread across the country. But what was interesting for me was that it wasn't simply that I now knew something about medical history, but it put a complete new interpretation on the content of those documents, which I thought could just be separated from the paper and the letter and the dust. Because if I opened a letter and it smelled a little of vinegar, I suddenly realized that somebody saying, you know, business is fine, send us your goods, our credit is nothing to worry about, probably was overstating a situation which was quite perilous. And so I began to read these letters in a new light, and suddenly the sense that all there was information in the writing and noise or interference from the paper itself came to seem a problematic distinction, which I think is one now as we try to transfer things from books onto the web, as we try to scan information and leave, as it were, this husk behind, start to seem to me much more problematic than I realized before.
So did you find any correspondences with vinegar?
Yes, several. And in fact, occasionally you would pick up a letter and it would look like a piece of Gruyere cheese. It would be holes almost completely because they'd over-vinegared it and almost everything had gone. But yes, no, you still do find that once in a while you'll open a letter and there is that sharp smell of vinegar and you read with an especial new interest.
Well, Paul Duguid, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Paul Duguid is the co-author of The Social Life of Information. He's a historian who is a consultant at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.